Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. We're here today because Bob Shane of the Kingston Trio passed away January 26, 2020. He was 85 years old, and he was on my program, a live interview in September of 2007, and it is one of the very first interviews that I did on WFMU. For years, I just sort of played music. And then right around 2006, 2007, I started interviewing folks. And Bob Shane is one of the first folks I talked to. He was just an important character in my own childhood because my parents were so into the Kingston Trio. And they had a record player that you could stack LPs up. And they would stack 6, 7, 8 LPs up in a row. And the record player would change them automatically. Then they would pick up the stack, turn it over, and we'd hear the other side of all those records. And in my memory, it's probably not, I don't know how true this is, but I remember that those stacks of records would sort of stay the same for months on end till they would get sick of them and sort of change the stack around. So I would hear these same Kingston Trio LPs. They were the mainstays of the stacks of records. I would hear these over and over again. My parents just didn't have that many albums. And it's funny because I do not think about this band's music too often, but when I hear some of it, it is embedded in a deep part of my brain. Every syllable, every inflection, every lick, all the instrumentation, the harmonies, it's just all in my brain, whether I want it to be or not, just because I was exposed to it so often and for such a prolonged period of time. Eventually, I started buying my own records and sort of I remember taking those stacks off and putting my own records on. But so they're an important band. I think today they are maybe not remembered for being quite as huge as they were. They were a huge band, sold a ton of records in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and they also influenced tons of folks to pick up an acoustic guitar and learn old folk songs and to learn harmony singing. And I think a lot of those people ended up being in rock bands, and certainly the folk rockers, you know, the Byrds, bands like even like the Beach Boys, all those bands listened to the Kingston Trio as kids. And, you know, the Beach Boys striped shirts, I think, come from the Kingston Trio. So they were a hugely influential band and a huge band in their own time. So this is a sort of a no-holds-barred, live, unedited phone call with Bob Shane of the Kingston Trio. I seem to remember he was a little bit gruff, but sort of lovably so. And I really enjoyed this, and I think it's definitely a link in the rock and roll chain. One memorable moment, he used he calls Dave Guard, who quit the band, a jerk, or they fired him from the band. I don't remember. You'll have to listen to it, but he uses the word jerk. That's about as tough as it gets. So sorry that Bob Shane has left us, but check out this interview, me and Bob Shane from 2007. Enjoy.
Lonesome Valley, hanging from a white oak tree. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Oh, well, now, boy.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry.
Oh, well, I...
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Yeah, the Kingston Trio here on the mighty WFMU. It is a great day to be talking with Bob Shane, a great year to be talking with Bob Shane from the Kingston Trio, because the Kingston Trio are 50 years old. Bob, welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm great.
50 years of something. That's amazing.
Yeah, it sure is.
It really is. It's just incredible. And I was listening to that song, and I was thinking, when is the last time a top 10 record had a banjo in it? A long time ago.
Yeah, right.
The band, you're from Hawaii, which a lot of people don't know, and Dave Guard from the original trio was from Hawaii. Also, what was it like growing up in Hawaii? What music were you listening to?
We were listening to the Weavers, and we were listening to Hank Williams Sr. and Harry Belafonte, and a lot of calypso music and a lot of Hawaiian music.
Hmm. An interesting sort of background. You met Dave Guard when?
Met Dave in high school.
And did you start playing together right away?
No, I was just learning to play the tenor guitar, and I talked his parents into getting him a guitar for Christmas. And then he got a guitar. We've in our senior year, well, in our junior year, we played in a variety show that the school threw a carnival every year to get money to earn to make money. And then Dave went on to high school in his senior year in California, and I stayed in Hawaii. And then we ran into each other when we were in college because he was at Stanford and I was at Menlo, which is about a mile away from Stanford. And that's where I met Nick Reynolds,
who filled out the original Kingston Trio.
Right.
And did you guys get together and say, "We'll just play some frat parties"? Or where were you guys first? Where were the first gigs?
Well, actually, Nick and I sang together in college as a duet, and we played a lot of places, bars and beer gardens and frat parties and stuff. But it wasn't until we got out of college and I had gone back to Hawaii and become a single, and David started a group with Nick, and then the girl and the bass player were married, and they left together. And so Nick called me up and said, "You want to start a trio?" And I said, "Sure." So I came back, and this is in the late 1956. And then in 57, we started the trio.
You had gone back, I think your dad ran a sporting goods
Wholesale sporting goods and toys, yeah.
And did you ever think, that's going to be my life, not too bad?
Well, that's what I was going to college for, was to learn business, to take over my father's business.
I guess that business training later came in very handy.
Oh, yeah, sure.
With the Kingston Trio. So you guys get together, and like you said, there were a couple other folks in the band. They finally called you back, and pretty quickly the band kind of exploded.
Well, we decided we'd try it for a year to see what happened, and if nothing happened, we'd go back along our merry ways. But in the first year, we had a million-seller hit with Tom Dooley.
Yeah, not bad, not bad at all. Tell me, when you got together, was the blend completely natural? Was it something you guys worked on and honed?
No, we were naturals. We were all naturals, and everything we did, we head arranged. There was nothing. We didn't read music. I still don't.
Hmm. And you talk about the tenor guitar. It seems like everybody in the band played a little guitar, a little banjo, tenor guitar. Nick plays the bongos a lot, and that's pretty much it. There's some bass on the records. What is the tenor guitar exactly?
Tenor guitar is a four-string guitar, and it's a lot easier to play than a regular six-string guitar, but it has a higher pitch to it, so it with that and the regular guitar and a banjo, it give an unusual sound that they really hadn't heard it, except for the Weavers.
Hmm. Yeah, it definitely makes that Kingston Trio sound very apparent right away. There was a great nightclub scene in that very early 60s, and you guys were working a lot in San Francisco, the Hungry Eye and the Purple Onion, places like that. What was that scene like? It seems like there's no equivalent to that today.
Well, the Purple Onion was a first-time discovery club. It's for really unknown people. The Hungry Eye, which was across the street, was a more of a place that was people were starting to hit. And so we always said it took a year and a trip to New York City to get across the street from the Purple Onion.
Just that short walk took
a
year.
We came to New York and played the Village Vanguard. And then went back, and then we got across the street to the Hungry Eye.
That's great. This guy Frank Werber was your manager, an integral part of the trio. Really, he was the sort of
the beginning of the trio. He was very inspirational and very instrumental in getting us to rehearse and really work on our stage presence.
And he got you a deal with Capitol Records, one of the giant record companies. Where were those first records recorded?
When were they recorded, or where were they recorded?
Where?
At Capitol, at the old studios at the circular building on Vine Street there in
Hollywood, California.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the same place Frank Sinatra made all those records. And were you guys recording? Is everything live? Are there overdubs? Is everyone singing together?
Well, we recorded an interesting way. Boyle Gilmore, the guy who produced us, also produced Sinatra. And what he did with us is he did voiceovers, by having us re-sing the exact same parts we had sung on this time before to give it a fullness.
So you kind of doubled some of the parts.
We doubled all the parts.
Oh, really? That's really interesting. Yeah, there is a real fullness, and as we just said, Tom Dooley shot to number one, I think it was 58. Yeah.
Right.
Were they surprised by the success of the record?
Yeah, everybody was.
I think the album was on the charts for 195 weeks.
That's how we, Tom Dooley is how we became folk singers. We never called ourselves folk singers. We didn't call ourselves anything. We started off playing calypso.
I wanted to ask you about that because you do get described as folk singers, and often in music, anyone who holds an acoustic guitar gets called a folk singer. But actually,
the amusing thing is we never called ourselves anything. But in order to sell you, they had to call you something. So what they did is they realized that we played bongos and banjos and guitars, and they figured that we didn't look country because we didn't talk like that, and. So they said, okay, you're a folk singer. So if a guy hands you a lot of money and says, here, you're a folk singer, you say, you bet your fanny I am. You know, I'll be anything you want. And then they realized 1958 was the first year of the Grammys, and they didn't have a folk singing category the first year, so they looked around and found part of our business that needed help, and they gave us the first Grammy ever given for Best Country and Western Presentation of the Year.
Yeah, that's amazing, which they very quickly after that changed, and they added a folk category, which I believe you won the following year.
We won the first one for folk, too, but the country people never even noticed the fact that country music was dead in sales in 57 and 58, and the only person who gave us credit for that was Minnie Pearl, and she came up to us one time, and she said, thank God for the acceptance of that song. You've saved country music.
Hmm.
So we had a T-shirt made up that said, the Hawaiian Calypso Folk Group Who Saved Country Music.
Yeah. You guys were on the cover of Life magazine. You were also on loads and loads of television shows, scores of television shows. And I think part of that has to do with you'd played live so much and honed your act that you guys were naturally relaxed and funny.
Well, that's all we ever tried to be, was a live professional entertainment act. And that's all we ever really wanted to be. Even in our biggest years of selling records, we still made more money off of personal appearances.
That's interesting. I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but did you have a good deal with Capitol Records, and did they treat you fairly?
Oh, yes. They all did. You know, they made a lot of money off of you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how many albums did they...
At one time, we were responsible for over 22% of their entire gross.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's a label with, you know, Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and just scores of great folks. You had 13 albums in Billboard's top 10. Five of them went to number one. You had a bunch of hit singles. It's, you know, it's a lot of records. And over the 10 years that the original group was together, how many albums do you think you released?
We released over 15 albums for the first 10 years.
Yeah, easily. Yeah,
we did things. We traveled 285 days a year and still recorded 3 albums a year.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was that life for your family life to be on the road so much?
Well, families always were secondary in the beginning because you're trying to establish yourself in your business, and so they pretty much suffered in the beginning.
Yeah, and that's something you really have, you kept up until very recently, traveling at least half the year for the last almost 50 years.
Well, I was on the road for 47 years, and you know, the old saying in show business is they pay you to travel, you do the shows for free. And what happened to me is that we were traveling across country. I live in Phoenix, and we were going across country to do a show in Georgia and North Carolina and Boston area. And then on that trip, I said, God, how can I get out of this business? This is driving me nuts going back and forth. And so we came home after that tour and then 4 days off and went back to the same basic areas that we had just come from. And on the way back from that one, God showed me rather rudely how to get out of the business by giving me a heart attack in the doorway of the airplane.
Ouch. Wow.
I've been on oxygen ever since, but I haven't flown in 3 years, and I can't tell you how happy I am.
You're grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sometimes I guess, God just taps you on the shoulder.
After 7 million commercial air miles, you don't really care about that.
Yeah, you don't miss it. You guys were the biggest band in the United States of America. That's not an exaggeration.
That's right.
Yeah. I rented a documentary about the band recently. There's two of them out there, and one of them shows some clips of a TV pilot that the band made. It's a black and white situation comedy where you guys are sort of groovy bachelors all living together with jobs, and you kind of do jam sessions with girls dancing around you.
Yeah.
And you all, it looked great. I mean, I wished that that had been a series, because you were all so natural and it seemed so funny.
Well, we would have been the first ones to have a sitcom like that, but the trouble is that we lived in the San Francisco area, where we were very proud of living in that area, because it was really a lot of fun, and it was also a very nice city compared to Los Angeles, that we felt. And when they said we had to work 8 weeks a year in Phoenix and then 22 weeks a year in Los Angeles, we said, no, thank you.
Sure.
we have pride.
Well, it's one thing we can all just think about, what it would have been like. It would have been real interesting. The band had four albums in the top 10 at one point.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how big the band was. Tell me, I talked about those television shows. What was it like meeting all those people? I mean, you're from Hawaii. What was it? Was your mind going crazy?
No, I just I was made for the business. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great. Tell me about a few years into it, Dave Gard left the band, and this is one of the few things which there isn't really definitive information about. Why exactly did he leave the band?
Because he was a jerk.
Was he kicked out, or?
Well, he said, it either goes my way or I quit, and we said goodbye.
And what did he, what was his way? What did he want?
Not worth even telling about. So it was just stupidity.
Oh, really?
And he admitted to me before he died that that was the dumbest thing he ever did.
Yeah, he passed away of cancer in 91. Yeah, well, that's too bad. I always sort of wondered why do that. You ended up getting John Stewart in the band, and the band rolled on just a perfect fit. John was, again...
You know, John was great. We did hit records with him, and that went until 1967. Then we disbanded.
Right.
And then in 1968, I leased the name New Kingston Trio and went out for a few years as the New Kingston Trio. And then 1976, I bought the name and then went back out on the road as the Kingston Trio with various partners. And
Nick ended up joining you back for about 10 years. So.
Yeah, for about 10 years. Yeah. And then we just kept on going. And now there's the group without any of the originals, but I own the name, and it's sanctioned by me, and we just keep it going because it's a live act and it's real good.
Yeah, it's a great tradition to sort of keep going because the songs sort of need to stay out there forever.
We put an interesting CD out just recently called The First 50 Years. And it's two songs from each of nine groups we had.
Wow. Yeah, there was a sort of slowly evolving, but you always kept the quality high.
Yeah, sure. You know, as I said, we are a prime vendor.
Whoa. You there, Bob?
Hello?
Hello, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. We talked about the songs. You guys had a great ear for songs. You had to make 15 albums in 10 years. You wrote a lot of the songs. A lot of the songs were traditional songs you guys adapted, but there's some songs like It Was a Very Good Year, the first time that I ever saw your face that Roberta Flack covered, Long Black Veil, Seasons in the Sun, a lot of songs that were giant hits that you guys sort of had your ear to the ground, Early Morning Rain. Where were you finding all these songs?
We had a lot of friends who were in the business who were writing songs, and we had a lot of people that we knew in the business that would come out with the song and we'd cover it, and some people would give us the credit and then not the people that actually originally made it. Just like people did to us, you know. There's lots of people. Sinatra covered one of our songs, and he also made the nicest comment about me ever when they asked him. They knew he likes the song Scotch and Soda, and asked him how come he never recorded it, and he said it could never be recorded any better than it was originally.
That's very interesting. Where did It Was a Very Good Year come from?
That was written by Irvin Drake, who lives in New York City. He's still alive. A friend of his said to him, how fast do you write songs? He said, oh, I can write songs real fast. He said, well, who's one of your favorite people? I said, well, if I did a song for the Kingston Trio, I could write a song for the lead singer in that in 10 minutes. And so he did, and that's how he wrote that song.
That was written just for you. Wow.
He wrote it in 10 minutes.
Nice. That was a well-spent 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great version in that time, sort of, I guess, after the trio disbanded and before you decided to put the new Kingston Trio together, where you made some solo records, including a recording of the song Honey.
Yeah.
And Bobby Goldsboro ended up covering it almost exactly the same.
Yeah, he used my arrangement.
Yeah, he was a guest on the show a few months ago, and he said he heard it, and he thought, oh, this is a hit record right here, you know. Why wasn't your version a hit record?
Because we had gone with Decca Records, and we had just quit Decca Records when we retired in 67. So they were kind of, dated on us, I guess. Mm. And when the song came out, I had 300,000 orders, and Decca Records hadn't covered the first 100,000 yet.
Mm.
And so I got off of Decca Records as a result of that, thank God, because they weren't doing anything at all, obviously. They missed the two hits that I had. But it made me realize, being out there and traveling around, made me realize I did not enjoy working as a single. I enjoyed working as a group.
For a while, did you imagine that you would sort of evolve into a 60s singer-songwriter, sort of like Bobby Goldsboro, cutting pop records?
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to do once we got out of the Kingston Trio, but from doing that, it made me realize I really didn't enjoy that end of it.
Yes. So you put together the new Kingston Trio, and then you got back the name the Kingston Trio. In 81, the band got back together, all the different iterations of the band, including back with Dave again.
Yeah.
And again, there was a little bit of bad blood, I guess, because Dave is a jerk, right?
Well, he was, yeah. He just was misguided.
Yeah, he seemed like an interesting guy. He ended up going to Australia and hosting a TV show, and then a lot of Eastern music and all kinds of different things.
Well, he did what he wanted to. You know, we paid him enough money so he could do that for a while.
Hmm. And then Nick, another guy, seemed to have a great sense of humor and seemed like a lot of fun, him back in the band. Tell me about what each of those guys, you know, because it seemed like in some ways the Kingston Trio, like you said, a group situation is just different from a solo.
Well, you see, the trouble is that Dave didn't realize. Dave did a lot of the arrangements in the beginning, and he got some of the good songs, too, but we all did. But Dave didn't realize that it was really three guys and their output, their individual output, made up the whole. And actually, the real sound of the group was Nick and I singing. Nick singing harmony to me was just the whole crux of the thing, and then Dave added on whatever part it needed on top of that.
Hmm.
But when Dave left, all we had to get is another singer, and we sounded exactly the same. You know, it was just the same energy, the same feeling that it had been in the original. And that's what I've kept it up as. Every time I've started another group, that's what I tried to do, is keep up the energy.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you do all day now that you don't have to fly, 50 weeks a year?
Well, I'm fifth generation from Hawaii, and I was made to be lazy. I'm having a wonderful time.
You live out in Phoenix. Do you pick up the guitar?
Oh, yeah.
And do you still... Now, tell me about the Fantasy Camp. There's a Kingston Trio Fantasy Camp every year.
No, it's not the Kingston Trio Fantasy Camp. It's called Trio Fantasy Camp.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Nick Reynolds was the guy that sold me the name, so he can't use Kingston. And he and John Stewart are the ones that started this thing called Trio Fantasy Camp, where campers pay $3,000 or so apiece to come out for 3 days and be one of the Kingston Trio.
It's a pretty fascinating concept. And what are the crowds like?
I like to go and see it. Of course, I'm still good friends with them, so I go and see it, and I get up on stage with them and stuff, too, but I don't have anything to do with it.
But it is interesting that here's you, Nick, and John all up on stage still singing and still having a great time, with a bunch of adoring fans. I mean, I think that's something nice about that.
Oh, yeah, that's really nice.
So what?
That's cool.
What do you listen to when you drive to the supermarket?
I listen to all kinds of music, always have. The greatest thing about the radio is you can switch stations.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's always music for every generation. There's always, you know, there's all kinds of music for every generation. And but as I said once to a young kid that I met, he was talking to me about the comparison of his music and what I did for a living. And I said, well, the only way I can put it is at that time, REO Speedwagon was pretty big. And I said, sing me one of their songs. And the guy went, So it's about the same.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to find out how music lasts, you ask somebody to sing one of the songs of the people that they like. And you find that there's not many people that can do that.
What did you think about the Beatles when they came along? Because they really sort of, you know, a seismic change in the music.
They took over our entire slot, which is fine. The Beatles should have. We were playing in England, and we saw the Beatles, and we said, you know, that's going to be a big group sometime. And we got back to California, and we told the people at Capitol Records about the Beatles, forgetting that Capitol Records was owned by an English corporation. And so they said, oh, really? And then they dropped us on our contract when it came time to renew, and they hired the Beatles.
Amazing.
Just shut up, you know.
Yeah, that's what you get. I've got queued up here the tune Scotch and Soda. We talked about it a little bit earlier. It's my favorite Kingston Trio track. I think it's a lot of folks'
favorite.
Well,
I'll tell you one thing to start with. Dave Gard did not write it. His name's on it, but he did not write it. The song was an anonymous song that was collected by the family of Tom Seavers, the baseball pitcher. We got it from his mother and father when he was 9 years old. And
they just said, here's a song you guys might like?
They had heard it on their honeymoon in Phoenix in 1932, and they had made it their song, and it was written by a backroom piano player, and he wrote the music out for them, and he forgot to sign it, and they forgot what his name was. So, but Dave, at a later date, put his name on it and gave the initial money to the Seavers family to send him through college. And then left his name on it, and we didn't realize he had done that on the side. This is another thing that brought him bad karma, is that he put his name on several of the songs that were public domain, and he figured he could do that and he'd collect all the money. And then when we found it out, he said that he agreed to split the money with us in even three ways, and never did that. And he brought a lot of bad karma on himself, and I think that's what basically killed him.
Wow. They heard it on their honeymoon in 1932, and they actually had a barroom piano player write out some sheet music for it?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is an amazing song, and that what you said about Frank Sinatra, just amazing. Yeah, it would be impossible to... do you remember recording the song? Do you remember that day?
Yes, I do.
What was it like?
It was just a laid-back time. I asked Buck Wheat, our bass player at the time, if he would play the guitar on it, because I didn't have quite the right feel for it. So I played it softly, but he played the main licks.
And is he playing, he overdubbed the bass?
No, he was playing guitar.
Is there bass on that record?
Oh, yes. He played the bass, too.
Oh, so he overdubbed the bass as well. That's very interesting. And did you think, wow...
Actually, I played the guitar, and he played the bass to start with, and then he overdubbed his guitar on top of that, because he played a classical guitar, and he got a little bit better sounds out of it.
Interesting. And did you think, when it was over and you listened to the playback, did they say, good job, kid, or was it just another...
No, that was just a song that was one of the songs on our first album.
Yeah, recording in 3 days.
That was what the first album was, the show that we were doing in San Francisco.
So it was easy to just reel
we
off.
We just walked into the studio, and in 2 days we cut the album and left.
Yeah, amazing. Well, it's an amazing record. We're going to hear from it right now. Bob Shane from the Kingston Trio, thank you so much. Really a fascinating story, you know, and a big part of American music, a huge chapter.
Well, we always tell kids that the interesting thing about our music is we never aimed it at any age group. It was for anybody. And as a result of it, when people listened to us, young guys listened to us, they figured it was easy and they could pick up guitars and do it themselves. and Martin Guitar Company has admitted that the Kingston Trio's popularity playing Martin guitars all their life put them so far behind in production they had to build a new factory.
Yeah, I think you're right. Those very early years of the Kingston Trio, they sold everybody was playing an acoustic guitar. I mean,
right.
It was a sensation in America.
They were playing Martin acoustic guitars.
You've always been, how many guitars you got in your house?
I've got 11.
Oh, that's not too bad.
They're all for sale.
Oh, yeah? Well, let's talk. Okay. Bob, thanks so much. Let's hear a Scotch and Soda now. And, if you're ever in New York, please... I guess you'd have to take a train, but drop by.
Well, if you got to get a hold of us, try KingstonTrio.com. It works great.
Okay. Thanks so much, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Scotch and soda, mud in your eye. Baby, do I feel high, oh me, oh my. Do I feel high? Dry martini, jigger of gin. Oh, what a spell you've got me in, oh my. Do I feel high? People won't believe me. They'll think that I'm just bragging. But I could feel the way I do.